Thanks very much, Bill, for a wide-ranging talk, certainly. I'll ask for questions, discussion, and perhaps the way we can structure it is that we can have sort of several people making contributions, and then Bill can sort of try to take them together rather than do one each individually, because if we do it like that, people tend to get left out. So please do put your hands up if you wish to ask questions. Yeah, okay.
I'd like to touch on the BBC programme and mention Milo. It both interrupted and was interrupted. I noticed that this business about women getting paid less than men, and it shouldn't be like that in the BBC. Most of them were well-educated middle-class women on a decent salary, maybe less than the men. I don't hear these same women speaking up for the cleaners that work in the BBC for low wages. So is this a question of self-interest, Morgan?
Okay, fine. Yeah, Mike?
Yeah, I was just really good, by the way. Excellent. Contrasting pre-capitalist and capitalist is quite useful. And as I think the speaker was saying, in a way, some of that gets kind of morphed in to the way capitalism still operates in practice. On the back of that, I'd be interested to know how you look at the issue of unwaged housework in the traditional marriage, for instance. The speaker emphasised the social nature, if you like, of production in capitalist society, and in some ways you could extend that and look at capitalism as a whole, as a kind of social factory. But there are other aspects that contribute indirectly rather than directly. So, in other words, not directly through the wage system, but indirectly through unpaid labour, still a factor in modern capitalism. The obvious one is the context of with women raising children, comes back to the issue of children, looking after children and so on. There is another one, however, which is that given that we live in a world capitalist system, there is still forms of bondage and slavery on quite a wide scale, which sustains capitalism, even though it's not inherent to the classic mode of capitalist production. So the concept of social factory has been developed by some Marxists, but has also been misused by some feminist Marxists as well, I think. And there was the whole campaign around the idea of wages for housework, for instance, which in a way, like psychologically, recognise that the issue at the end of the day was wages and was the wages system, but presumably it raised an issue. I don't actually think most of them believed they were going to get a reform out of it, but some people did treat it as a genuine desire for the state to intervene as the regulatory mechanism. And you mentioned how different capitalists do call upon the state sometimes to regulate to avoid unfair competition and all the rest of it. And I think it sort of comes in around that. So just be interested in what the speaker thinks.
Should we just have another couple of comments if we're off at the moment? Or do you want to come back on those two?
If it gives someone time to think. Could someone get me some more water, please? I'm really sorry. I've used up all my supplies. So the question of the BBC gender pay gap. Oh, that's very kind, thank you. Solidarity with the cleaners would be helpful. Of course, the problem with sort of a lot of the highlight on the top stars is it is a very atypical situation, is that you've got people who are unique. You know, Andrew Neil is paid because uniquely he is Andrew Neil and Joe Coburn. You know, so these people can command these vast salaries, and particularly as it's a public sector broadcaster, you know, there is no product. It's just however much they can afford to pay. But there is one feature to this, which is that a lot of legislation around the wage relationship is driven by the people at the upper end of the wage scale, because they're the ones who can afford to take people to court. So it's almost always it's women bankers who win the tribunal cases because they can afford to fight them, that sets a new benchmark for equalities in the workplace. And I think this sort of comes back to last night, that yes, we've got, although we have atypical varieties among the working class, there is some this element of commonality between all workers, irrespective of their actual how much they're remunerated within capitalism. But the idea that of opening up, I mean, again, another thing that a friend of mine working at John Lewis told me that he was forbidden from discussing his salary with his colleagues, and the Equalities Act actually makes that arrangement entirely illegal, because you have to be able to compare so that women in the workplace can find out if they're being paid less than a man doing the same job. You can't have this level of secrecy. So there are these elements of there is the commonality of the labour market for all workers. At the front here, yes, a very, very interesting point. Yes, I neglected to mention that the world system, but obviously that is a part and parcel, because if you've got, this is why cheap labour in foreign fields works, because if they can pay very low paid workers buttons and then bring it over here, they can realise much more value. So, you know, you've got the tea pickers and the coffee pickers, they have a very low cost of their labour power, but they still have a physical human frame that works 12 hours a day. That's 12 hours of effective labour that goes to whoever eventually finally sells on the processed coffee. And of course, unless things have changed recently, the EU have a particular trick that raw coffee beans can come through with a low tariff, but processed coffee has a higher tariff. So it basically means that you have to come in and do the value added work here, and of course that means that it captures the value, whoever does the roasting and the making of the instant coffee. And yes, wages for housework. I think that's what Mazzucato was looking towards, that sort of idea. And of course, that has its own problematic in terms of, well, it's practically that's another name for the universal benefit, I suppose, in a sort of reality. But unless the wife is going to have to, or the house partner is going to have to sign a clocking in sheet and, you know, write down what they did to earn the housework money this day. It does illustrate, I mean, I suppose we can bring in a time when the party was both right and wrong. So regarding the attack on the family allowance, so yes, we're absolutely right to call it a redistribution of poverty, because in reality it wasn't a gain for the working class as a class. But one of the things it did was it was money that was given directly to the women. And what we're hearing about now is, with universal credit being paid on a household, women are becoming more dependent on their partners again, and this is happening in these situations, and with the obvious knock-on effects for domestic abuse that entails. And I think that is sometimes where you can go, okay, there's a difference here between the class analysis and maybe another sort of analysis. And I don't think necessarily to turn around and say, because our argument was realistically, it's not a gain for the class, but that doesn't mean that we oppose it as a reform as such. Although I think the writers at the time did say we oppose it, but, you know.
Okay, fine, yeah.
Yeah, do you think this might go back to the fact that you get the early times trade unions were quite anti-women and they didn't really want women in the workforce, and we're still run by a patriarchal society, so the men are still making decisions about women's wages and so forth?
Right, nobody else has got the hand up at the moment, so did you want to say something about that?
Yes, that's an entire theme that I cut out of the talk on utopianism, because the point I was going to make is, and you can still find people to this day who are proud trade unionists who will then tell you the miners got the women and children out of the mines, and that was an achievement, and that meant that the women didn't have to work. And they're very proud of this fact, and of course, in some ways, that was a big organising principle of the trade unions. If you read Marx on this, I think some people try and feminise him a bit much, feministise him a bit more, because he does talk about, you know, the free labour in the home being replaced by being dragged into the workplace, free labour in the home, and, you know, the little ladies being able to come into the work and therefore undercut the big strapping men. And that was certainly how it was seen. I think that the element I was going to go down was, in successive turns, you know, within the class struggle, there's an element of looking upwards at the ruling class. So how the ruling class live? Well, their ladies live a life of leisure, of course, because they've got servants. And how would, and this is obviously from a male working class perspective, how would they want their women to be treated? Well, they'd like their women to be free to sit around and have leisure, and, you know, I can provide that for her, and, you know, that makes me a successful man. That is, yes, you're right, a patriarchal, utopian sort of idea. And it's really interesting because you look at, this is ranging onto a real divergence, some of Osama bin Laden's pronouncements when he was still at large. And it was fascinating to read them because you get the anti-Islamist strident anti-Islamist, you know, cruise missile types who hate Islam, and they go, look at how they treat their women. Isn't it disgraceful how they treat the women? They make them wear burqas, they cover them up. And then Osama bin Laden's writing, have you seen how the Americans treat their women? They make them wear skimpy clothes. They make it's pretty much seems to be always in war. Have you seen how they treat their women? Seems to be one of the rallying cries of either side. And yes, I think it is a feature of the pure idea of that men work and that women didn't. And Morris, William Morris in News from Nowhere, had this entire chapter, of course, about, you know, how it would be great. You know, of course women should work, and of course what's the work they're doing? They're bringing the food to the table for the men. And in his mild defence, people criticised him at the time, so later on the foreman of the obstinate resistors is a woman. She'd rather stay and finish building a bridge than go take in the harvest. So I think he learned his lesson quite quickly.
Yeah, just one point. You said the miners proud of that. I mean, a lot of the children and women were got out of the mines because of the kind of moral Christian thing, wasn't it? That men and women working together and they were there in the same boat. That was a big moral thing, really, wasn't it? Rather than the miners getting women out of the...
Well, that's how the miners... Yes, I agree. I mean, that was eventually how it was won, because, of course, people were practically naked down there because it was hot in the mines. So you couldn't have naked men, women and children together in a dark pit. That would be awful.
Can I just ask you something? You mentioned William Morris, Bill. I mean, I had William Morris in my mind at that very moment because of the sort of gendered roles which he seems to depict in News from Nowhere. But... the question is, I mean, capitalism is a gendered society in many ways, or maybe becoming less so, but, I mean, would socialism be a gendered society? And if so, would it actually matter?
Well, that's what I put out. I did suggest, you know, try to steer the conversation. And it depends. In some ways, it could be entirely harmless, but if it leads to a differential in power, because there's an inherent power in if someone's doing a type of work, they can withdraw their labour and therefore inflict harm on society, then the fact that some people are, you know, all the men are doing one thing, that means that there could be some sort of power imbalance in society. But if the way men and women perceive themselves is that men do certain tasks and women do other tasks, men do the filing and women do the computer programming or whatever, you know, that's probably not that harmful. It only becomes harmful when it becomes, you start preventing people. So, of course, yes, because the big difference between the early 20th century when women just weren't allowed to work and now where they're working, but they're kind of gravitating towards roles that are perceived as feminist, and so that's the people mentioned, the science, technology, medicine research area where women are underrepresented in the workplace. As I said, currently that means that there's a difference in the amount of money that they're making and also within the hierarchies of organisations. Because I think a lot of the reason for the gender gap is this prevalence towards women cleaners. Because every organisation has cleaners, so you'll have men in the offices getting paid quite a lot because they're senior managers, and there'll be lots of women who are cleaners in the firm. And now they might be cleaners for a reason, because it fits in with, you know, it's a job that starts in the morning, but they can go home and look after kids or what have you. Or it could be that they're there because they feel that that's the only work that they can find. I mean, that's... But of course, the point is, without cleaners, there's no Bill Gates. The cleaners in Bill Gates' offices, I mean, the corporations don't pay cleaners for love. They pay them because it's needed for people to do the work. And if people can't work because the offices are dirty, then the work doesn't get done. So they're just as deserving of a share in society and the share of the product of society as Bill Gates is.
Dave, do we need to go and research this? During World War One and World War Two, and obviously all the men were going off doing something else on the hospital. So all the male jobs from tram drivers, bus drivers, post women, whatever, all these posts that were filled by women, do we know whether they were actually paid the going rate or were they underpaid because they were women, even though they were doing those particular jobs, male jobs?
You know, I have a half memory about this. Of course, we do know that during the war, because women had to do their own mansplaining. Come on, that's a good joke. I know, certainly, because my friend in the local history archive, we have actually covered this, because during the centenary of the war sort of stuff, I think they were paid a lesser rate. And then, so the women tram drivers in Bristol were. And then when the men came back from the war, they were kicked out of their jobs, unceremoniously. so it was very much seen as, thanks for filling in, but the boys are back. Well, the boys who are, you know, trained in how to kill people and might be very angry about going back to unemployment need their jobs back. But certainly that was a big issue at the time. I don't think that they were getting paid the full rate. Well, of course, they were working in the munitions factories as well and all this sort of thing and getting poisoned and killed and maimed.
Richard, do you want to say something else?
Yeah, about paid workers in the jobs for women, particularly in the First World War, and that the only reason why women were allowed to drive trams and so forth was most of these jobs were unionised at the time, and the government promised that once the war was over, the women would be chucked out and be put back into their jobs. Okay. So there were temporary employers.
Yeah, just to say that Rose in the Riveter is quite an interesting book to read. When we're in the producing the all the munitions and cars and stuff like that, it's quite a famous book. Anyone know about it?
Well, we do now.
Yeah, good.
Can I just come back to the question of work and gender work differences in socialism? It's the point's often made that today in capitalism there are a lot more men in science, technology, engineering, medicine, women, and it's not fair, and something's got to be done about this, and universities have prevailed upon to try and make sure, you know, the gap is closed, as it were. So there are a lot more men doing these jobs than women, and this gap needs to be closed because these are relatively highly paid jobs and women aren't sort of able to get them and so on. I mean, if in a socialist society it were to be found that there were still more men than women doing these jobs, because I don't know, there was something about the makeup of men and women which made it more likely that men would be interested in these jobs and be able to do these jobs, for example, would it matter? I suppose that was the crux of my question, really.
Well, I'm interested to hear other people's opinions on that. I think part of it comes down to this question that we were tending towards last night. This point about, okay, we have the socialist revolution, and of course I think that it would take a long time for things like gender perceptions of what people do to change. I think that certainly would last for a long time. And I mean, at the present moment there are adverts out there to try and encourage girls. Yes, they're aimed at girls, to go into STEM subjects,
yeah.
And to encourage that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if I was a bit younger and had socialism, then instead of doing the jobs that I've done in the unions, working in different situations in employment, I'd want to stay home and do the cleaning for the kids. And so I'd be one of those people that would, you know, that would continue to accentuate what seems as a problem under capitalism. I don't see it as a problem under socialism, because people have a choice.
Okay. Yeah. I suppose that's the... Yeah. Matt, go on, yeah.
Well, this will go into other discussions, presumably, as the day goes on, but... I mean, one of the problems is, because it is still in this society around childbirth, that looking after children, that is a factor, an unfortunate factor, that pushes a lot of women into making choices that they would make quite differently if things were more equal, more equal in this society, but certainly, if there was the security, if you like, and the freedom that you'd associate with a socialist society. So, I mean, you know, some women decide not to have children at all because they feel it's a problem. In fact, you know, there are parts of the world, even Catholic, good old Catholic Italy, apparently birth rates sort of shooting down. I mean, there's been suggestions that, you know, some of that is factored into women's choices. I don't know whether it is or it isn't. But, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? That will always be a factor until you take natural child procreation, if you like, and childbirth, until you take that out of the question altogether. And, of course, that has been explored in some women's fiction and science fiction, you know, because it's sort of down to that. But, I mean, that's where it all goes wrong, isn't it? I mean, we don't need that. We don't need to have to manipulate things to such an extent, sort of scientifically, as it were, to create a situation where the only solution is for creating children and raising them to be taken completely out of the natural environment and the natural human condition. What you need is a social arrangement that enables people to make genuine choices according to what they want individually or as groups of people. So that is a huge change, but it's a massive problem, I think, now in this society, you know.
Paddy, do you want to say something?
I don't know if anybody here likes tennis. I never watch sports, but any other sport. I like tennis. I remember the results. And something I've noticed over the years that I've been watching, about 30 years that I've been watching, is that what's happened is that the women's game has changed massively. Anybody who knows anything about tennis knows this. And that the women players today are bigger and faster and more powerful than they've ever been. They're doing 120 mile an hour serves now, whereas when I was first watching back in the 1970s, they were doing 70 mile an hour serves. And now they were just popping the thing over the net and doing these huge long rallies that went on for about 20 minutes a game, because there's no power in the game. Now at that time, 30 years ago or so, they were paid massively differently from the men. The women's prize money was massively lower than the men's.
What can you do? You've got a book to open, didn't you, if you want?
Did she? Yeah, it wasn't a lot of money. And, but the argument was, well, you know, you're not playing the same game. A woman's game can be over in 2 sets, whereas a man's game can take 5 sets. And it recently we saw one player who broke the world record and played an 11.5 hour match. And then a few years later, just this last one, he had to do the same thing nearly again. He had to do a 6.5 hour match for 5 sets, and it was absolutely exhausting. You can see that we're both completely knackered at the end of it. But what Wimbledon has done in recent years is it's now pays the women and men the same prize money, even though the women's game can be over in 2 sets and the men's can go to 5. So it's clearly a disparity in that sense, an objective disparity in the work that they're doing. You know, women do a maximum of 3 sets, that's it. The men do a minimum of 3 sets. So. But the pay is the same. And I thought that was quite interesting because the argument was that, well, it's not about the work that you do, it's about the punters that you bring in. So if you're a player, top woman player, and you can fill the centre court like the top players can, it makes no difference if you do it 2 out of 2 sets or 5 sets. You're still filling the... You're bringing the punters in and you're bringing in the ticket money. And actually, there's a similar argument has been going on with the top Hollywood actors and the women actors, who are saying, well, actually, it's not right that we're getting half or a third of what the male actors are getting when we're pulling the punters into the top. You know, we're just as box office as the men are. So that's a whole debate. But it's all being driven by money. It goes back to what you were saying, Bill, about, you know, ultimately the wage gap and the pay gap is caused by the wages. It's all money driven. Brings me on to my other thing about what would happen in a socialist society when you've taken out the money factor. There isn't money driving this process anymore. Would you continue to get big, fast, powerful women tennis players, say, in socialism? Probably your first instinct is to say, who cares? because after all it's just a game. But the same question would apply to any journal. Would more women STEM subjects, say, would more men go into childcare or caring professions? And when you take the money factor out there, actually what we realise is that nobody knows. We actually don't have any idea about any of this. Because we don't understand enough about genetics. We do know, for example, that there are literally hundreds of different genetic markers in women for men. It's everything to do with brain size, even the way that your fingers are arranged. If you're a man, you'll probably notice that the third finger, your ring finger, is slightly higher than your first finger, index finger. You can try it now, stick your hand up. If you're a woman, you'll find that probably your first finger is higher than your ring finger. Okay? On average.
I'm a woman.
I knew it!
It's surprising how often that works. But there are things like that, little genetic differences that don't mean anything, but they're there. And because of all these things, they have no real way of knowing how this will unfold in a society that, for the first time in history, is free of the coercive elements that money and power have introduced. Because of that coercion, we've never been free to develop our genetic capabilities. Socialism will allow that for the first time. And if it turns out that women like or prefer certain things more than men do, I think so what? That's fine.
Thanks, Paddy.
Mike, yes.
I suppose just to sort of follow on from what Paddy just said, and I'm playing devil's advocate here. I don't believe that this particular sort of anecdote or supposed fact that I've heard, but apparently there are some arguments that the different structures of men and women's brains account for men apparently going into more sort of mechanistic kind of roles, you know, in terms of some branches of science or maths, for example. And some people, I believe this myself, have said that's what accounts for those sort of differences. It's sort of structural differences in the brain, and the sort of the flip side of that is apparently, according to these arguments, that the supposedly more sort of caring, nurturing aspects are wired into women's brains, which account for them going more likely to be going into sort of, say, nursing, for example. So there are those arguments that the structure of men's and women's brains differ, and that accounts for different roles. I mean, it doesn't in itself account for the pay gap, but it accounts for a sort of a scientific division of labour, I suppose you could call it. That doesn't seem... to me, that seems like a massive generalisation, and it's sort of quite dismissive to, women who are, excellent at maths or, good at mechanics and, vice versa, men in sort of caring professions. But that argument has been sort of thrown out there to apparently explain the different gendered roles.
Right, I think,
sort of reply to that, I'm not just playing the devil's advocate. Presumably the brain develops within a patriarchal society, and that would be the reason why, the connections are made in a certain way depending on your gender, rather than actually anything inherently genetic.
Richard, do you want to say something?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're getting a bit bogged down here about gender roles, aren't we? Surely the issue is complete equality between genders, and that both have the opportunity to achieve their potential. And it doesn't really matter whether women or men go into any particular profession, providing there's an equal opportunity for both to achieve their potential. And that is the important thing in socialism. It won't be like putting obstacles or driving people here or driving them there. It's about people actually wanting to do what they actually feel most comfortable with.
Yeah, okay. Hi, come back
in
a few
those. Yeah.
So on childbirth, I did say in the talk that although childbirth, I think it becomes an ideological obsession in these situations, we could organise work, certainly in the modern world, around childbirth a lot more than we do. It's not the burden that employers make it out to be. Now, I made this point during the pre-general election previous, not the 2015 election. And I'll say it's incredible that, you know, child rearing, child birth, all this sort of thing is an afterthought of our society rather than being the first organising principle that we should be starting from. How do we look after the children and then sort everything else from there? At the count, the Tory candidate's wife came up to me and said, that point really struck home. It was so difficult. We have to decide whether or not to get a nanny. So, yes, but I think the point is that the childbirth is a factor, and certainly would be in a you know, primitive hunter gatherer society, a much bigger factor than it is here, and would account for why women would be static and forage, and the men would go hunt, and that's the kind of the. Someone will probably shout at me and say that's not how it worked, but anyway, that particular assumed model.
But weren't they more equal then?
but they were equally members of that society.
Despite
that, yeah, absolutely. On tennis, I believe Serena, because what was that film that was out about the man versus woman match? I
can't Battle of the Sexes.
Battle of the Sexes. Yeah, so reading around it, Serena Williams reckons she could probably beat the 350th best man in the world. That's kind of her kind of rough, because of, you know, the other 350 are just bigger and stronger. But I think one example that maybe illustrates Paddy's point would be an international rules match between Ireland and Australia. I've seen a couple of these, and you get the Gaelic footballers are amateurs, strictly amateurs. And so, you know, they talk about a guy playing at Croke Park in front of 10,000 people and signing on the next day. This sort of thing. And, you know, they're fairly beefy lads, but then the Australian Aussie rules players, the second stringers that they send to play the international rules match, and they're all 9 foot tall and their muscles are just rippling up and down because they have the space and the time purely to train, and also you're drawing on a pool of talent that is attracted by the big rewards of Aussie rules football. And generally the Aussies win, so I don't know what if we absent the incentive of money. Of course, the Gaelic footballers are there as an example that people would still play sports to an elite level, and so that's interesting. Although what's the third one? No, just to say, when I was researching this scene on gender roles. When I first read about the relationship between the hind and the bondage, I kind of like had this image of like a milkmaid, or women doing work around the farm that, you know, they'd seen the film and it was, you know, they're out in the fields harvesting the crops and doing the backbreaking work. But the fact that it was still seen as women's work, I think I just find that really interesting of why that was exclusively seen in that way, in that particular arrangement, in that particular part of the world. And I think it does come down to, in the end, like you said, it's equality is the chief thing. If there's equality of conditions, I think that's why what we can bring to the discussion on the gender gap is, of course, we should have an equal share in the products of society. Once we've cracked that, then a lot of the other problems can be addressed through spending time and effort, basically, on resolving them.
Yeah.
I think we've got to get away from this idea of fixating women on childbirth and that, which is actually fundamental. But if you look at, I mean, with hunter-gatherers, for instance, I mean, 80% of the food that's produced by hunter-gatherers is produced by women. It's not that you've got women sitting in caves and the men going out hunting. The opposite, actually, it's the women are the main producers. Not only in hunter-gatherer societies, but in peasant. I spend a lot of time in Malawi. Most of the food in Malawi is produced by women. The main producers of the economy are women, not men. And so we've got to get away there. And I think it's going back to the thing. It's, what is the freedom of men and women to choose whatever roles in society they want? And the other is the equality between them, whatever they want to do. But I think we're kind of fixated with this idea that women in the home and, you know, not producing, the men are the producers. It's completely, you know, to things. If you look at earlier society, we so often talk about this as the past. We're not talking about the past. I did research in South India among hunter-gatherers, you know, in the 1970s, and that was the situation. Women were the producers. I was in Malawi last year, and it's still the same. Women are the producers. They're the main economic producers in Malawi, you know. And so, you know, I think you've got to keep that in mind, as it were, all the time, rather than just seeing women and looking after children. You know, they do look after children. They are mainly responsible children in many societies, but that's not all that they do. You know.
Any more Heinz or bondages want to ask questions or make comments? No. Well, shall we wrap it up there, Bill? Thank you very much for a wide-ranging talk and a good discussion as well.